Hachette Audio presents Unsolved, written by James Patterson and David Ellis. Read by Brittany Presley and Kevin T. Collins. 1. I am neither evil nor deranged. I am not uneducated. I am not poor. And I am not the product of an abusive upbringing. I do what I do for one and only one reason. The man in the beige jacket pulls his SUV into the strip mall parking lot and kills the engine. He steps out of the car, straightens his jacket, and lightly brushes his hand against the bulge at his side, the concealed handgun. The setting summer sun casts a dim glow over the strip mall, nearly empty. The laundromat at the end is dark. The catering service is shuttered, a metal grate across the window. The convenience store, displaying ads for cigarettes, beer, 2 for $1 hot dogs, Powerball tickets, is the only thing open. There is one other vehicle in the lot, a Dodge Caravan the color of rust, that's parked nose in about 8 spaces away. A man in a wheelchair is in the middle of the lot. He bends over at the waist, reaches down to the pavement, and struggles to pick up several items that have spilled out of a plastic grocery bag. He also works the joystick on the arm of his wheelchair, but in vain. The motorized chair fails to respond to the command. A disabled man in a broken wheelchair. Only moralists or lemmings think that weakness requires compassion and mercy. Any student of history, of science, knows the opposite is true. We are supposed to extinguish the weak. It always has been, and always will be so. The man in beige calls out, "How about I give you a hand with that, mister?" The wheelchair guy straightens up with some difficulty. His face is red and shiny with sweat from the effort of trying to retrieve the toiletries rolling around on the pavement. He is wearing a camouflage hat and an army fatigue jacket. Decent upper body build, to be expected of someone who's lost the use of his legs. His unshaven face is weathered and dull, except for a small shiny scar in the shape of a crescent moon near his right eye.
"I suppose I could use a hand," says the wheelchair guy. "I appreciate that. No trouble at all."
Nothing like the gentle facade of manners, of charity, to reel in your prey. Far easier than lying in the weeds and waiting for the wounded animal in the pack to come limping by, unsuspecting.
"Not a problem at all," the man in beige says again.
He scoops up a tube of Crest toothpaste, a stick of deodorant, and a green bottle of Pert shampoo, puts all the items into the man's plastic grocery bag, and hands the bag back to the wheelchair guy, who is struggling between gratitude and wounded pride, a feeling of helplessness. The guy pushes on the joystick again, but again, the wheelchair fails to respond. The wheelchair guy curses under his breath.
"Having some trouble with your wheelchair?" asks the man in beige. "Need help getting in the van?"
"Don't talk to me about cruelty or pity. The thinking man has no affections, no prejudices, only a heart of stone. I am as I was made. I am a product of the laws of nature, not of laws passed by some inane body of human beings." The wheelchair guy lets out a sigh.
"Well, actually, that would be great."
"Sure, no problem."
The man in beige extends his hand. "I'm Joe," he says.
"Charlie," the wheelchair guy says, shaking his hand.
"Nice to meet you, Charlie. Where do you get in the van?"
"The back."
The man in beige, Joe, takes the handles of the wheelchair and wheels Charlie to the back of the van. He reaches for the door, but Charlie hits a button on his key fob, and the door slides open automatically.
"Cool,"
says Joe. Never seen that on a back door.
You probably never been in no wheelchair, neither.
Charlie punches another button on his key fob to activate the hydraulic drop-down ramp. Joe pushes Charlie up the ramp and into the bed of the van. The ramp rises up and folds back into place. The van's interior is customized, of course. There is a front passenger seat and a rear one directly behind it, but the other side is a clear path to the steering wheel, which has manual controls to operate the van. A nice, open space.
This is where I will kill him. But I will not be cruel. That word again. I have no desire to inflict more pain than is necessary to eliminate him. But first, a little conversation, for distraction, and to keep the victim at ease.
Joe looks down at the bed of the van and sees a hardcover book lying there, a tattered bookmark jutting out from the middle of it. The book is titled The Invisible Killer, The Hunt for Graham, the Most Prolific Serial Killer of Our Time. Joe picks up the book and opens it to a random page.
Hey, I know this person, he says. The FBI analyst who caught Graham, Emmy Dockery.
Charlie works his joystick and rotates in his wheelchair until he's facing Joe.
You know Emmy Dockery? Well, she emailed and called me. I'm a cop, see, and I had a case I thought was an accidental death, but Emmy, she asked me to reopen it as a homicide investigation.
Joe squats down and gently places the book back where he found it as darkness begins to creep over the van's interior. The rear door closes with an ominous thunk.
Ah, so it was Emmy who made you reopen the Laura Berg case, says Charlie. I couldn't be sure.
In the process of straightening up, Detective Joseph Halstead registers all this in the time it takes his heart to beat once. Laura Berg. The controls on Charlie's wheelchair suddenly working, the rear door closing, before he feels the electrode darts hit him in the stomach. The detective jerks at the jolt of electricity seizing his body and immediately loses muscle control. He collapses onto the bed of the van hard, unable to break his fall.
You immediately discounted me as a threat, says Charlie. Even you, an officer of the law.
One hand, still holding the trigger, continuing to deliver the powerful charge to his victim, Charlie reaches down to the bag by his side and removes three pairs of handcuffs, a large plastic bag, a rubber racquetball.
You feel like a prisoner, trapped in your own body, he says. You feel vulnerable and helpless.
Detective Halstead lies on the floor of the van, his body convulsing, his eyes wide, his mouth hanging open like a dropped drawbridge.
If it's any consolation, Emmy was right, says Charlie. Laura Berg's death was not an accident. Yours won't be either.